Parupaya Patibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santatami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavadvashinim.
So we're in chapter 12. The last two verses we may get through. Verse 19, the first one. Verse 19 is actually considered the final verse of chapter 12 in terms of subject matter. Verse 20 just summarizes the whole chapter.
Tulyanindastutirmani Santushto yena kena chit Santushto yena kena chit Aniketastiram matihi Bhaktiman me priyo naraha
Tulya Ninda stutihi. Tulya ninda stutihi. Mauni santushtaha yena kena chit. Aniketaha stiramatihi. Bhaktiman me priyaha naraha. Here in the previous verse, he says, the one who is samaha, the same. The same equipoise in the presence of one's friends or in the presence of one's enemies. The mind doesn't react in a negative situation. So there's a shanti in both situations, when you're with your friends and also when you're with those who are inimical to you. And then he says, and similarly, the one who has that samatva, that sameness, that abidingness in the presence of those who respect you, as well as in the presence of those who disrespect you. So that's the mana, upamana. Okay? Now here, what he says, he goes, the one who is tulya, tulya is the same as samaha, the one who is tulya, the same in censure and in praise. So it's a little bit different than respect and disrespect. The one who has the same abiding, inner abiding, when they're being disrespected, as the same inner abiding when they're being respected. So ninda means disrespect. I mean censure, criticism, and stuti means praise. So the one who maintains an underlying shanti with these two things, tulya ninda stutihi. So here, I was reading Swamiji's commentary on it, and he brought up something that I think is really important. The underlying shanti of your being, the self, that it's really the very self that your mind, with ajnanam, with ignorance, the self that you take yourself to be, I, this conscious being, that I label as me. With viveka, with discrimination, the conscious being that I am, really, is the one who is present to every experience that I have. If I have a happy experience, if I have a sad experience, if I have a happy emotion, a sad emotion, a negative situation, a positive situation, the underlying self, the constant, the me that is present to all of these experiences, is by nature shanti. That's your nature. That's the nature of the Atma. It means yourself, the nature of your being is never fluctuating. It is whole and complete and full and ever-present as me. We don't usually do a viveka on this word, the word me or I lands on. We don't do a viveka because the viveka means discrimination. We don't do that viveka because the I is already totally superimposed upon whatever the mood may be, or whatever the emotion may be, or whatever the intellection may be, or the memory may be. I'm remembering this. So the I is always kind of consumed and swallowed by the experience that we're having. But that is not true for ajnani. And remember, all of these verses that we're doing now are really descriptive of ajnani, of somebody who has knowledge, and also become kind of sadhanas in terms of values or remembrance for a mumukshu. And so for ajnani, the ahankara, the I, instead of ahankara, just the I, the word I, actually lands on the one, the stable self, that is present in all experience and never changes. It never changes, it can't change, because that's the very nature of your swarupa, it's the very nature of who you are. And so if the viveka, if discrimination is there, your mind, like say somebody is doing ninda. Ninda means very critical or angry at you or critical about something that you've done. Your mind might have a little vishesha, means have a little response to that. There may be a little response there. The response, but well, let me tell you a little bit about this, what I mean by response. There may be a response. The response is like writing on water, because there's nobody coming in and building up on the response, which is the situation that in samsara we have. You don't just have a response that's kind of a response to the situation that's being generated. You have a response, and then you have a whole network of thoughts about the response. So say somebody is criticizing you. You may have a hurt response. It may generate a hurt. But what it won't generate, we're talking about a jnani now, what it, for the most part, would not generate is all of the comments that you have around the hurt response, such as, how could this person hurt me like this? I didn't deserve such a hurt, you know? And on and on and on and on until we build up a web around it. That type of response isn't going to be there, you know? But the immediate, what we call vishesha, the immediate, kind of the attribute that comes along with such a behavior can be there, but it's there like riding on water. And more importantly than even that is that yourself is not touched by the response. Atma is not touched by the response. The mind takes on that thought modification, but your being remains the same. Now the same is with stuti, with praise. With praise you can feel kind of a little elation. Somebody praises you and it's a positive. You're being kind of bathed in something positive as opposed to being bathed in something negative. And so there can be a positive reaction. You know? That will come and go. But that's that's true, but it's not the point. The point is that yourself is not has no sangha, no attachment to the different reactions and vrittis that are taking place in the mind. And so what that means is that your mind is always the same, whether it's stuti, whether it's praise. Yourself is always the same, whether it's a vritti that's brought about by praise or a vritti that's brought about by censorship. Nothing happens to you. And so here when he says, the tulya, there's sameness in reference to ninda and stuti. You can say, actually, there's tulya, sameness in reference to any million vrittis, million variety of emotions. There's that tulya. And to make it, like your mind might say, how can I be the same in every reaction? I'm talking about the mind. We're talking about you. You are the same in every reaction. You are the same, no matter what the feed, whatever is coming at your way. You are the same because you can't change. It's not you're not the same because you're trying to be the same, or because you're working at it. Let me be the same. Whatever has nothing to do with that. It has to do with your nature. Your nature remains unchanged. And so, if that viveka, the discrimination, is there, that tulyatvam, that state of being whole and full and unchanging, is the reality. It's not a worked-for reality. So now what that means is that there is no distance between your being, conscious being, and the mind. It's not like the mind is out here and conscious being is that, like, there's any kind of a distance. It's more like the clay pot, right? Where the pot has for its being clay. And like that, your mind has for its truth, for its being, you, the conscious being that you are. So the viveka is not a viveka between a right side and a left side, or an up and down. It's the viveka between, in a sense, two orders of reality. What I mean by that is that you, your being, is changelessly present and feeling in the very substance of every experience that you have. And it's not as though there's the experiences over here and the self is over here. So the very being that every experience has that tulya, has that samatvam. It never changes. It is the self, the content of all experience, but it's also untouched by all experience. That's why we say two orders of reality. You can't say that within this creation, if there's any change, everything, things are, if there is a change, the thing that is changing is affected by the change, right? If there's a change in this order of reality, the thing that is changing is affected by the change, right? In this here, there's a difference. Your presence, the me, the conscious being that you are, right, is pervasive in the very self of what is changing. It's the very existence, the very being of what is changing. But itself is not changing, right? And so that means if itself is not changing, it is the being of what's changing, but itself is not changing, then it has complete asangatvam. There's asangatvam, and yet there means non-attachment. It's not attached, it's not touching it. But at the same time, this experience has you for itself. And the only way that can be possible is if there's two orders of reality. It's kind of like rope snake. The rope is totally asanga, unattached from the snake. If a snake is imagined on a rope, right? The rope is totally asanga. It's totally unattached from the snake, and yet there's no distance between the snake and the rope at all. The rope is the self of the snake. The two orders of reality. The snake can't touch the rope. And from the standpoint of the rope, there is no snake even. So here, this viveka, this discrimination, has to take place in terms of your own psyche, in terms of your own experience. In terms of your own experience, it's going to be like this. At exactly the same time and place, right, there is your self-shining presence, the conscious being that you are, always immovable and not something that you can ever turn your back on. It's the very conscious being that is both the center and the periphery of all experience. There's no experience that you can have that is devoid of your own presence. Now this presence is self-shining, the me, it's self-shining, and it is the constant self that is present to every experience that you have. And at the same time, it's the same time as the self-evident experience of me is there, there is the experience of all of the thought flow that you have. The thought flow includes all of the emotions that are flying through. The emotions that are flying through, the different vrittis, the different thought modifications, the different memories, the imaginations, anything that the mind is capable of producing, those are happening at the same time and place. So say you have a vritti, a thought modification, and you have yourself. So now you have to have a viveka where you recognize the difference between my changeless presence and the thoughts, moods, emotions that are coming and going. So for Ajnani, my changeless presence, that's where the I lands. When I say I am, it doesn't land on the mind or the body, it lands on me, right? And then the different thoughts and qualities of the mind, those things, those understandings land on the mind. And so I'm recognizing at any given moment the changelessness of my own presence, which is tulya, samaha. It never changes in any way. And I'm also recognizing whatever changing vrittis are taking place. If the vrittis are colorful or they have a touch of emotion here or there, it doesn't make any difference at all. If you have an emotional vritti, you have feelings, you have perceptions, you have imaginations, you have a life. Right? So life is taking place. Right? Life is taking place in all of its color, all of its positive and negative. But it's taking place in fullness, in the fullness of your own being, which is what we say aparoksha to you. Aparoksha means it's self-evident. This aparoksha term is aparoksha for every jiva with every living being, with or without self-knowledge. Right? The self is aparoksha experientially. What we mean is that everyone will say, I am, I exist, I am a conscious being. That labeling will go on. You'll label yourself, which is known to you as you, not as an object. That's aparoksha, it's self-shining. You don't think about it, you take it for granted. You know, I am, I exist. There's no philosophy or analysis necessarily going on. It's just a fact. So that's aparoksha. We say for a jnani, that same aparoksha form is there, that same state of self-immediacy, self-evident nature. But I have knowledge. My mind has knowledge where it's differentiated this self-shining me from all the experiences that come and go. So for the jnani, I have aparoksha jnanam. I have direct, immediate recognition of myself. My mind, through teaching, has done that viveka. Viveka means it has recognized itself as mithya. The mithya mind has recognized itself as mithya and has recognized the self. Mithya means as being totally dependent and of a different order of reality, in a sense, from conscious being, and totally dependent on conscious being for itself. So the mind from teaching, you know, the mithya teacher is teaching the mithya student, so that the mithya mind can recognize, can differentiate itself from me, the one that is whole and complete and full and invariable, the invariable in all experience. That's the aparoksha atma. And so here, this samatvam or tulyatvam is really, it's that the whole teaching is wrapped up in this. Because the only thing really that is tulya or sama means it never goes through any change amidst all of the changing experiences is the atma. Anything else that is bound by change is influencing whatever is there in the same order of reality. But I am not that order of reality. I am the very conscious being which is the self of all of that, but not bound by the change of that order of reality. Just like in the dream, you are not affected, you know, by any changes that are or the existence or any changes that take place in the dream. The waker is not affected. If you have a huge meal in the dream, Swamiji will always joke, you have a huge meal in the dream, you still wake up hungry. Right? If you've taken, you've become wealthy in the dream, you know,
you
still wake up poor. Or vice versa. You'd be a very wealthy person, and then in the dream you've lost all your wealth, you've lost everything, you know. I've had a dream like, not exactly like that, but where something really frightening happens in the dream, like losing your purse or something like that, you know? Something happens in the dream and you wake up, you know, you say, oh, it was only a dream. Mm-hmm. What a huge relief. Nothing, you're not touched in the dream. Right? It's the same. You're not touched in any way by this creation. But the same, whatever is in the same order of reality as the creation is touched. But the self is not touched. Your being is not touched. The I is not touched. And in fact, that is your immediate experience. We just usually don't discern it because all of our means of knowledge are totally enmeshed, are part of the mithya, are part of this order of reality, and so are totally involved within this duality, and that's all the mind knows. The mind totally takes for granted your presence. It just takes your the changelessness of your presence. It doesn't notice. It only notices your presence in reference to whatever thoughts or moods or emotions are there. Now we need to discern that. It's almost like discerning the backdrop of all of your experience. You are the backdrop, the changeless backdrop of all of your experience. And the nature of that changeless backdrop is ananda. Ananda means the very wholeness, the fullness that you strive to find in the world. And you get little glimpses of it. Every time you fulfill a desire, that ananda as though explodes in the mind. You may have gone through all kinds of grief and worry and tension to fulfill the desire, but when it comes your way and it's fulfilled, in that moment the mind is desireless. And the wholeness of yourself is not impeded or in competition with an agitated, frustrated, worried, anxious mind. You notice this type of wholeness anytime, in fact, when you have a reprieve from anxiety. At those moments, all is well with me. It's just the creation is not bothering you at that time. Right? And so the mind is not in competition. It's not forming all kinds of emotional experiences that you can identify with. For jnani, because the viveka is there, I am always the same. It doesn't matter what the mind is cooking up. And it doesn't matter. I don't depend upon the world to provide me with experiences which I have given my okay to, which allows the mind to have a shantavritti so that I can feel full. When the viveka is complete, the fullness of myself is illumining whatever experience happens to be there, positive or negative. And because of that, the positive and negative experiences are like, in a sense, like riding on water, because you're not losing anything. For an ajnani, if you have a negative experience, because there's no viveka, there's no discrimination, the I is stuck with that experience, and the experience is an unhappy one, then because of the lack of discrimination, I am now unhappy. And the last thing, it's the opposite of my nature. And I am not comfortable being what I am not. It's a very uncomfortable situation. And so we scramble to get back to who I am as though, because we're totally identified with the mind. And so we have to keep creating these shantavrittis in the mind so that I can feel like myself. But not for jnani. For jnani, you don't depend upon the shantavritti. Yourself is the shanti which shantavrittis and ashantavrittis enjoy. Peaceful vrittis and agitated vrittis enjoy. Those all take place in the shanti of your being that can never be touched. So this is the tulya that they're talking about here. Then he says, after that being so, the one who's the same, tulya ninda stutihi, mauni. Mauni means the one who is silent. Ear silent doesn't mean that you have to walk around not talking. That means every wise person shouldn't be talking then. It's not the point. That's not the point at all. The point is that with knowledge, you have no pressure to talk. Swamiji has a very nice write-up on this, if you have the handout. There's no pressure to talk. And that's what, for instance, pressure to talk is gossip, for instance. Somebody hurts your feelings and you have to talk about it, or somebody does something that you don't approve of, it's something to talk about. There's pressure to talk. Somebody does this or that or this happens. Pressure, 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 you have to talk about it. You have to spew in one way or another. What if there's no pressure? If there's no pressure to talk, then the talking is useful talking. You're talking because there's something useful to say. You're not talking because of buildup or pressure. And so then the speech is naturally circumspect. You don't have any, because you don't have any pressure to say something that's not useful to say. Okay? Notice it in yourself. That's why Sometimes we practice Maunam. It's a mumukshu as a seeker, you know, a seeker. You can practice Maunam, not talking, physically not talking. And then you'll understand this word that Swamiji uses that is a really valuable word. Then you'll understand pressure. What that you have a pressure to talk. And then you can see what, you can just ask yourself, look at, what is that? But the thing is when you're not talking, it just shows up right in front of your face what that pressure is. And you'll often realize, you know, you'll realize that that is absolutely useless thing to say. And not to anybody's advantage either, to say, you know. So that's why we practice. We used to do 3-4 days at a time at the ashram in Indy when I was there, sometimes for a week. And then for a while it was just once, every Monday. It was a very good exercise for just understanding your mind and notice what your mind is like when there is no pressure. And and the relationship of that to speech. And you have no need to talk. And so that when you have no need to talk, then when you talk, there's something meaningful. That's Maunam. Then he says, santushtaha yena kenachit. The one who is satisfied by whatever. Yena kenachit. Whatever. The idea is, yadrichaya means by... There's another Gita verse that uses this, yadrichaya. Whatever comes your way. You know? But that, you're satisfied with that. The reason, though, that you're satisfied with that is that you're satisfied. And your satisfaction, your state of satisfaction, has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the very nature of the self. So another way of saying it is that instead of just saying you're satisfied by whatever, you know, whatever comes your way, satisfied, you experience whatever comes your way. Because the nature of satisfaction is your own being. And so when your mind resting in your own being, you know, enjoy satisfaction, and from that satisfied state experiences the world. So somebody in the world will say, oh, look, that person's just satisfied with whatever. They're just happy with whatever comes. But you could really say they're just happy. And it has nothing to do with whatever comes. Right? So whatever comes can come. And you think they're happy because of whatever's coming, but actually they're happy with their happiness or wholeness has nothing to do with what is coming. And so, but because of that, you can be happy with whatever comes, because the happiness, the source of happiness, is the self. And it's not superimposed on the world. And when that's the case, I can be present to whatever comes. Totally present. Because I'm not asking whatever is coming my way to be different so that I can be happy. I might take action to help or improve a situation because that's what's being called for. But I'm not doing that so that I can be happy. Happily, I do that. It's a big difference. Happily, out of fullness, I try to improve the situation because that's what's being called for. But I'm not trying to improve it so that then I can be happy. It's a big difference, you know. And it allows you to be present to the situation and to really be with the people that are actually there. You know, and be with the life that you actually have. Otherwise, it's hard to be with the life we have. You know, if it's very hard to really engage in the life we have if we're looking for it to be our source of happiness, then all these raga dveshas, these likes and dislikes come in. In order for me to be happy, you have to behave like this. In order for me to be happy, my house has to look like this. It's on and on. In order for me to be happy, my mind has to be like this. In order for me to be happy, my body has to be like this. You know, it's endless, really. But what if my mind has discovered the source of this happy experience, whole experience, to be my very self? And what is the distance between my mind and my being? There's no distance. It's like the distance between the pot and the clay. There's no distance. And so when that being so, there is no journey and there's no threat. The mind no longer has any threat. Anything that can come between me and my ananda. You know? Because otherwise, in the world, any of you could at any time get in my way. Come between me and the object of my happiness. And when you're not coming in the way, but actually helping me to attain the object of my happiness, then I love you. And you're really good. Really good people. Such good people. I have so much respect for you. So much gratitude. And then you change. You've now changed your mind. You're now not helping me. You're actually working against me to get what I need to be happy.
You always knew it about us.
I didn't know it. I didn't expect it. And it's a very hurtful. I didn't know you were like that. It's happened. On and on and on and on and on. That's samsara. That's a samsara, you know. But what about when I'm not asking that? Those things, thoughts don't come because I'm not asking it. How can you get between my mind and its source of ananda when the source of ananda is the very self of my mind? And when my mind knows that, it reveling in myself, which will never change, can never change, and can never be away from the mind. If nothing can, reveling in myself, enjoying the fullness of myself, I can be with you as you are without being threatened. Because what can you do? What can you do? Not only that, what can I do about it? What can my mind do about it? My mind can't even spoil it. Because my mind can't get rid of that. You know, we worry more about the damage we do to ourselves or the damage our mind can do to us, you know. And other people, we can run away from other people, but the mind itself can cause so much damage. But what about when the mind can't even do that? Because it's what is holding it and not away from it is whole and complete. So the mind can just always resolve itself into the self. It's so much freedom, you know. I remember when I was a little girl, well, not little girl, maybe 14 or 15, having this thought, just happened to notice this horrible thing, that I could be feeling perfectly happy and everything is fine. Everything's just fine. I could just walking along, everything is fine. And then something could happen. Somebody could say something. Somebody could raise their eyebrow in the wrong way. Something could happen, and my mind would change and react and be in a reaction and be in a state of pain, emotional pain, just like that. And it could happen at any time, out of the blue. It could be just innocently walking along. Something could happen, and your mind just changes into this painful state. And then you're stuck with it, you know, until at some point it evaporates at some point. Which point when that will happen, you don't really know. So I remember that was that realization. And I also remember feeling helpless. You know, because who would ask to have that reaction, that painful reaction, or to have your mind turn like that? Who would ask for that? Nobody. That means it just happens to you. You know, and I used to worry about that. Once I realized it, I was kind of tense about it. I remember that. So here, santushta yena kenachit, the one who's santushta, whose wholeness or well-being isn't at stake. So whatever comes your way, that's fine. You just deal with it. It can be positive, it can be negative, but then you respond to it in whatever way the situation is calling without losing your own well-being. So that state of santushtaha is just a given. It's given because it's your own swarupa. And then he says, aniketaha. Aniketa means the one who doesn't have a home, who is homeless. That doesn't mean that is a, what's meant there is not that you, to be a jnani, you now have to not have a home. It's that wherever you are is your home. This is my home. But I don't feel, if I go somewhere else, that that's not my home. Where I am, that is my home. Swamiji used to talk about this because, you know, for many years he only traveled from place to place, like week. He'd stay in one place for yajna for a week or 10 days, then go to the next place, then go to the next place. He did this for many, many years, and once in a while he'd land back at the ashram in Rishikesh and maybe get to stay for a couple of months. Yeah. And then it was sometimes 3 days, sometimes 5 days, going from place to place to place. And he told me once, told him not just me, but in the satsang, he said, I'm just at home where I am. But if I'm just at home where I am, then every place is my home and no place is my home. That's the aniketaha. It's an attitude. It has nothing to do with owning or not owning a home. It's a being able to be home where you are, aniketaha. And then the last one here is sthira matihi. Sthira matihi means the one whose mind, mati, or commitment, is sthira, means steady. And here Swamiji makes has an interesting discussion here. Let's say somebody were to say, well, couldn't my commitment or my focus be on money? I could be a sthira matihi in reference to money, or a sthira matihi in reference to power, or in reference to whatever, sthira matihi. No, you can't, because those things themselves aren't sthira. They're not steady. All of those things, the very things that you can be focused on themselves, are subject to change. And so there's no possibility of having that sthira, that firmness, in reference to something that is not firm, right, itself. So the only thing really that is sthira means that which comes from stha, that which is steady, which stays, is the atma. Stha, that which stands, that which remains in one place, is the self. And so the sthira matihi is the one whose mind is steady because its locus, its focus, is on what is sthira. What it's awake to is what is sthira, is what is unchanging. And that is the jivan mukta, the one whose mind sitting with the self, the mind sitting with the self, sthira, you know, experiences the world that is not sthira. The world is never sthira, is never steady. All experiences, can you imagine even to say, my mind is changeless? That would be like, we've stopped living. Right? The mind no longer changes. Well, that means you have one vritti. You're stuck. That one vritti is your experience then. The mind is continually changing. Right? Experience is continually changing. So you can't be sthira in reference to continually changing experience. You can only be sthira in reference to what is sthira. And what is sthira is the atma. And so the one whose mind never loses sight and never can lose sight. It's like, you know, the clay pot. It's like the pot, once it's discovered its relationship with the clay, how can it undiscover that? Once the pot has recognized its relationship with clay, which is that it is clay and nothing but clay, but the clay is changeless and it is dependent on it. Once it recognizes that, it can't unrecognize it. So once you recognize what is sthira, you can't unrecognize it, because there's no experience that you can't forget it. Because it's never not there. You can forget something that's not there. But you can't forget yourself, which is ever present. You forget something that has to be away, go away from you, and then you forget it. You can't forget your being, because your being is ever present and it is changeless. So the sthira matihi is the mind that has totally recognized that, is awake to it. Now, all of these other qualifications that we've gone through, all these verses that begin with the Dvaishta Sarvabhutanam in verse 13, all of these can be developed and can be had by a saintly, mature, saintly person. All of them except the sthira matihi. So these are really something that, like a karma yogi or sannyasi or saintly person, can develop relatively, but the sthira matihi is not available. The sthira matihi is only available to the one who has recognized the only one thing that is sthira, that is steady and changeless, which is your being. And your being is not an object to be attained in the world. It's a recognition that has to take place through teaching, through viveka, through discrimination. It has to be pointed out. And when it's recognized, it's recognized. And so that sthira matihi, he says, that person, bhaktiman, me priyaha naraha, that one who has this bhakti, being all of these things, that person, that naraha, that person, naraha means a person or a man, person, man being used for men and women. Naraha just means a person. But if I do the etymology, it means na riyate iti naraha, the one who never dies. The naraha, the person, is etymologically na riyate, the one who doesn't die. Because the Atma, who you really are, never dies. It's not subject to change, it's not subject to death. So he says, that Naraha, that Bhaktiman, is most beloved, is most beloved to me. What are we doing? You have to remember for all of these that Krishna is talking about the Jivan Mukta, the one who has gained this knowledge. And he says in this final verse, this gaining knowledge is really, Krishna would say, the Lord would say, gaining knowledge of me is not really gaining knowledge of my form, but gaining knowledge of me, the conscious being that I am. And gaining knowledge of this me is gaining knowledge of you. Right? And so the one who knows me is the most beloved. The one, so you have to list this, it's kind of a tricky language to really think about this. For the bhakta, the one who is devoted to me, knowing me as I am, right, recognizes that the devotee, the mamukshi, the student who's become a jnani, recognizes me, Krishna talking, but that me that is the most beloved is who they are. In other words, they are me. Their self is me. And that me is the most beloved. And so that bhakta is the most beloved to me, because what is most beloved is the self. And they have recognized that they are that self. And in fact, that self, that Atma, the Atma, is the most beloved to all beings, whether they have jnanam or ajnanam. It's just if they have ignorance, that same ananda is what they have superimposed on the world and then run after. But it's the ananda they're running after. It's not the object. You say, I want that object so badly so that I can be happy. You don't want the object. You want the happiness. Once that object, which inevitably will happen, doesn't make you happy anymore, it's a garage sale time. You don't care about the object, right? You don't care at all. You care about the ananda. The ananda is what is beloved.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so what about when you recognize that that ananda is me, but you recognize that that me is the very self of Krishna, is the very self of Ishvara, is the very self of all beings. And so the jnani has recognized, you know, that I am that self. Which is most beloved to Krishna? Which is most beloved to the Lord? Which is most beloved to all beings? Which is most beloved to me? And so he says, that bhaktiman, you know, is me priyaha, is beloved. That bhaktiman, who is a naraha, that person means the one who never dies, because that atma never dies, is most beloved to me. You have to understand, most beloved to me, because that bhakta has recognized that he or she is that self, which is the most beloved to all beings, actually. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's nice. Let's do this next verse, and I might not be able to do it all. We'll see, we'll finish it next week, maybe. Ye tu dharmyamritam idam. Ye tu dharmyamritam idam. Yatoktam paryupasate. Yatoktam paryupasate. Shraddhadanamat paramaha. Shraddhadanamat paramaha. Bhaktaste tiva me priyaha. Bhaktaste tiva me priyaha. Ye tu dharmya. Amritam idam yatha uktam paryupasate shraddhadanaha mat paramaha bhaktaha te ativa me priyaha. Ye tu, whereas though, he's just separating out now really the jivanmukta, the jnani. Those who pariupasate, they follow with devotion. Pariupasate, they follow yatoktam. Just as been said, this dharmya amritam, this life of dharma, this dharmya means that which, that idam dharmya, this way of being, which dharmya doesn't ever veer off from dharma, which is amrita. Amrita means it's free from death, it's immortal, right? Or it leads to moksha. You can say this dharma, this way of being, this life of dharma, which is amrita, leads to moksha. Dharma, amritam together means this. Yatoktam, just as been told, those who do that, shraddhadanaha, with shraddha. With shraddha means for the, when one begins on this knowledge, with this knowledge, learning this knowledge, there's a certain shraddha. You have shraddha in say the Upanishads or the scripture was teaching this. There's some shraddha. Shraddha means your mind is open and willing to listen. Most things we don't have any shraddha. You know, you're in it. You might have gone to the class or whatnot, and you have to sit there because you need to get the grades so you can graduate. You might be bored to death. You're doing it for another reason. You know. But here, for a person who is coming to learn, they have to have shraddha. It means their mind is available to listen. So they have to have a shraddha in the shruti, which means, Swamiji will say, faith pending understanding. an openness to listen, shraddha. They have to have shraddha in the teacher, faith pending understanding. You don't know if the teacher really knows anything or not. Something has to say, okay, I'm willing to study this knowledge with this teacher. Otherwise you'll have a value for the knowledge, but not with her, not with him. You know? And so then, situation's not right. You need shraddha also toward yourself. You know? Yourself. A faith in yourself to gain, to want and gain this knowledge. And a commitment to do that. You know? A certain commitment and a certain shraddha that in fact you can have this knowledge. It's kind of an interesting thing. It's a self-respect in a way. Not a self-ego, I don't mean that at all. But just a willingness for yourself to engage in this. Swamiji talks about it in his commentary. You can read it. He says, very nice. But there's a shraddha. Shraddha in Bhagavan. You know? But also you're good enough to gain this knowledge. And Bhagavan will help you. I remember, did you ever, anybody ever, when you were young, and if you're my age, you're young, that autobiography of a yogi? Oh, it was really upsetting for me when I read that, because the way that that book is written, you had to be so pure, so extraordinarily pure to be somebody who would be able to even consider gaining the knowledge. That one guy even jumped off a cliff so that he could take another body so that he would become pure. Pure enough to really gain the knowledge that this Sri Yukteswar or whoever had to give. And so it was, in my day and age, moksha or liberation or enlightenment was something for other people.
Special.
Special, very special people. It was not something that we could aspire to, and yet I wanted it so very badly. You know? But it was for another sort of people, according to these books. And it wasn't until I got to India and listened to Swamiji that I realized that we can have this knowledge. That it's not just for these people who are walking on air, you know, and some of them don't even eat. They eat the oxygen and the sunlight. That it's for you, that you can have this knowledge. And that is what, that's a huge shraddha. It has to translate into, I can have this knowledge. That I can actually have this knowledge. That itself is a huge recognition. I mean, just think, I can be liberated. I can be enlightened. I can have self-knowledge. I can be a jnani. I can be a jivan mukta. These words have been so removed, so far removed from human beings, just in the kind of the mythology of it, that you can not have the shraddha, you know, in yourself and in Bhagavan. That the mumukshutvam that you have is mumukshutvam. You know, that your desire for this knowledge is that sadhana chatushtaya. Those things are all there to an adequate degree to bring you to the teacher. And in fact, if you are even there with a teacher, with a mind that wants to gain that, that is the adhikaritvam. That's the adhikaritvam. You can't say you're not an adhikari if you have that. You can say, I'm weak in this and I'm weak in that and I'm weak in this and I'm weak in that. You're still an adhikari. And so there's a shraddha. And so those things have to be taken care of. That's the job. That's the sadhana. Taking care of all of these things. That you can have this knowledge fully and completely. There's a shraddha there. Big understanding. Because there's a lot of big ideas.
So I'm good enough then.
Good enough. I could go, Winnicott, for the psychologist, Winnicott has this idea of the good enough mother. You know, everybody wants the perfect parents. You know, Winnicott, this great psychologist, he'll say, You're good enough. You just be a good enough mother. You be a good enough Adhikari, that's all. That's good enough. It's good enough to gain this knowledge, to really gain this knowledge. So the Shraddha toward Bhagavan, toward yourself, toward the Shastra, the teaching, and toward the teacher, then these fourfold, Shraddha is there, then your mind is able to be available. Your mind is able anyway. But you need the Shraddha for your mind to be available. Otherwise the mind's not available. You could be fine, but your mind's not available without that Shraddha. So Shraddha Dhanaha, and that Mat Paramaha, the ones for whom I, Krishna talking, the Lord talking, for whom I am Parama, for whom there is nothing more important, for whom I am the ultimate. And now what he means here by the I is his I. His I is the Atma, the Akshara Brahma, the one for whom this self is paramount, is the most important. Not the car, not the new job. All of these things are important on a relative level. But my drishti means my vision. What is most important to me, you know, what is my love, what is my commitment, is to that Akshara Brahman, means that the self that is my very being, which is the being of Ishwara, which is the being of the whole. And so, as opposed to my commitment being on some object in the world, the commitment is on that which is the very being of the entire world, the self which is in the same in all beings. So that's the Mat Paramaha. Mm. Those bhaktas, he says, te ativa me priyaha. They are very ativa. They are very dear to me. That ativa, it's like saying they are the most dear to me. Why are they the most dear to me? Because they are my very being. Right? You have to remember that the bhakta, the jnani, you ask the jnani, who am I? It is that being which is the Ananda Sarupa. And that Ananda Sarupa is what is most dear. Even what is most dear to Ishvara. What is most dear to Krishna. What is most dear to all the devatas. What is most dear to all of the animals. Which is most dear to all beings. What is most dear is that Atma. Is the Atma which is Akshara Brahman. Akshara Brahman. When I say Krishna is Akshara Brahman, it means the recognition of this self, which is Akshara, means it's not subject to any type of change, you know, or dissolution, and which is infinite. The being infinite, and what infinite means? It is the self of all beings. That which is the self of all beings is Brahman. It means the very being of all, the very being of all beings is Brahman. Which is non-objectifiable, not an object in the world, but is the self of all objects in the world. It's self not an object in the world, it's the self of all objects in the world. It's not a thought, it's a self of. So you have the infinite number of thoughts, it's not the thought, it's the self of every thought. It's the self of my thought, and it's the self of your thought. It's the self of the whole universe. So, those people who are like this, all of these verses, those people who are like this, who are living this life, which is dharma. Dharma is really Ishvara. No. Dharma, the self, the self of Ishvara is amrita, it's changeless, and the whole creation is a, you can view the Lord as a manifestation of dharma, the infinite order of the creation. So those who are like this, you know, who follow this way, those mahatmas, really, those jivan muktas, those liberated beings, they are the very ativa, the very most dear to me, because they are my very self. So the self that I am is the self that Ishwara is, the self that you are, the self that all beings are. So with that, he ends this chapter. I don't have or something in this book. Begins this chapter, and we'll start chapter 13 next week. Oh, here it is. Repeat after me. No. I don't know if you have it there, but Om, Om, Srimat Paramahamsa Parivrajaka. Oh, this isn't the one. I don't have it. That's all right.
You want to see this one?
That one's yours.
Yes.
That's all right, I'll use Edward's. Okay. They always have just a couple of lines that ends every chapter. Okay. Om Tat Sat. Om Tat Sat. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Upanishad Su. Upanishad Su. Brahma Vidyayam. Brahma Vidyayam. Yoga Shastre. Yoga Shastre. Shri Krishna Arjuna Sambade, Shri Krishna Arjuna Sambade, Bhakti Yoga Nama, Bhakti Yoga Nama, Dwadasho Dhyayaha, Dwadasho Dhyayaha. Dwadasho Dhyayaha, this 12th chapter, Nama named Bhakti Yoga. Yoga here just means the chapter. The name of it is the Bhakti. So this 12th chapter, which is named Bhakti, which has the name of Bhakti, Sri Krishna Arjuna Samvade, in this dialogue, Samvada between Lord Krishna and Arjuna, Samvada means where there's, it's a dialogue where it's teaching. So in this teaching between Krishna and Arjuna, in this Yoga Shastra, in this Brahma Vidyayam Yoga Shastra, in this teaching of Brahma Vidya, which is also a Yoga Shastra, teaching the Karma Yoga as well as the knowledge of Brahman, in the Upanishad, so starting from the beginning, he goes like this, Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su, in these chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, so in the Bhagavad Gita, which is an Upanishad, means it is considered to be, it's not an Upanishad, but it's considered to be like as good as an Upanishad because it comes from the words of the Lord. And so even though it's a dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna, Krishna is teaching. And Krishna is an avatar of Ishwara. And so there's no, if the Upanishad, what the Upanishad says is not going to be different what the Lord Krishna says. So the Bhagavad Gita is, and also just upon analysis, it has the same tatpari, the same teaching as the Upanishads. So which is revered as an Upanishad? In this Brahma, which is Brahma Vidyayam, in this Brahma Vidya, this knowledge of Brahman, which is also a Yoga Shastra, Yoga Shastra teaching of the Karma Yoga. And in this dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, this 12th chapter, there's this 12th chapter, which is entitled Bhakti. Now, Bhakti. Swamiji says something very nice about this. Bhakti resolves into, what bhakti resolves into is also bhakti. And so when you start out with this karma yoga buddhi as a mumukshu, you start out with devotion to the shastra, to the guru, to Ishwara. And that bhakti resolves into jnana. The bhakti itself resolves into jnanam. Jnanam also is bhakti. Swamiji says like the something, if bhakti matures into something, what it matures into is also bhakti. And so there's no greater jnani, there's no greater bhakta than the jnani. Because jnanam is the fulfillment of that devotion. See what I mean? You are devoted, you want to know the Lord. You're a bhakta. You want to know the Lord. And then when you know the Lord, you don't all of a sudden not become a bhakta. That's the idea. So, okay, why don't we stop there? Take a moment.
Adav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Now, I still get a little tangled up with this concept. Maybe it's my conditioning. Those devotees are exceedingly beloved to me. It's like the devotee has developed characteristics that makes him lovable. You know?
No, it's because this is where you get lost there. For the Jivanmukta, the one who has this knowledge, when that Jivanmukta says, I am who I am, it resolves into the Atma. It's the Atma that is the most beloved. Not the body, not the mind, not the sense organs, not the beautiful qualities and all of that, that is most beloved. What is most beloved is the self. And so now for the one who has knowledge, are they the qualities or are they the self? Are they the states of mind or the beautiful qualities of the mind? Is that who they are? Or are those the qualities of the mind? Who are they? They are the Atma. The Atma is the most beloved, even for Krishna, for all beings, for Ishwar.
Because we're generally taught to make yourself lovable is to get those shining qualities or something shining about yourself, and then you will become most beloved.
Well, you know what, Fundy? In the outside samsara, you want to evoke people's love so that you can feel loved. Yeah. But actually what's happening is that if you're being given some sort of affection from the outside, it'll bring a shantavritti in your mind, which then allows the ananda which you are to manifest in that mind, which otherwise is maybe tense or feeling hurt. Maybe the mind depends upon outside stimulation to gain enough shanti to not obstruct, you know, or take the focus away from your own just well-being. It's like, for instance, if you break your arm, for instance, now the pain in your arm takes all the focus. Right? Until that arm is fixed, what you are experiencing is the pain in your arm. It's like that when the mind is in pain, yeah, all kinds of things are going on, but what is taking your focus is the pain in the mind. Right? When the mind's not in pain, then you're just responding to the world. You're fine. There's no problem. But when the mind is in pain, then the whole mind is rotating around it trying to fix the problem. And so if you have some external stimulation coming in that somehow relaxes the mind, right, then you really appreciate that so much, and I love you for making me feel better. And then you also learn, if I behave like this, maybe I'll feel loved. You know, if I act like this, maybe I'll feel loved. All of that. So we learn how to be in the world in ways to generate people to respond in a particular way so that we can relax and not feel in pain. Some of that's a good thing in terms of dharma. You learn from the creation also what what type of behavior gives you peace, and what kind of type of behavior generates more anxiety. We continually learn from the creation and in our relationships. That's what we call dharma. Dharma doesn't generate tension. You know, it's like we're moving along in the natural order of Ishvara. But the natural, or if we bump up against those laws, you know, we kind of are, it's like sticking your hand in fire and you learn from it. It produces tension or it feels, you don't feel at home with it. And so dharma is, gives us a certain natural shanti to the mind. But then we're still dependent on it. Instead of recognizing and that, recognizing the one that's independent, not dependent on dharma or adharma, not dependent on anything. It's its own self-shining nature.
But rather, when I invoke the Lord's grace, isn't that a duality?
To start with, like say you're, but it doesn't make any difference. Say if you ask Bhagawan, you the jiva, are asking Bhagawan to bless you so you can gain this knowledge, right? And so you're asking for Bhagawan's grace to provide a teacher, to provide a situation, to take care of the complexes and things in the mind that are stopping you from being able to abide in this knowledge. You pray to Bhagawan to bless you, you know. Then in the end, you can still be praying to Bhagawan for this or that or this or that, and at the same time, knowing yourself as the very self of the whole thing. It becomes more mitya, not mitya in a negative way. You know, just like I can have a very wonderful conversation with you, knowing that I am you. But that doesn't stop me from being able to have a conversation with you. You know.
So you don't really become more beloved to Ishvara. You see that you are that.
That's right. That's exactly right. You are the one that is the most beloved. That's the nature of the self.
Could you explain a little bit more? You said you didn't have Shraddha in four things. Mm. One of them was Bhagawan. Mm-hmm. I get the other three.
Uh-huh.
But that one, I'm not quite sure what it means and why that would be necessary or important.
What would it mean not to have Shraddha in Bhagawan?
I don't know what it means in the first place.
Well, let's see if I can say what it would mean to me. First of all, that there is a Bhagawan. You could say there is no Bhagawan. There is no God. There is no Ishvara. You could say, but if you have Shraddha is faith pending understanding. Where there's something inside of you that believes that there is something divine, that there is a God, you know, as opposed to there is no God. You can't really know one way or the other, right? You can't, but which side are you going toward? You know, like if you say there is no God, then what is this then? Also, And the idea of what, in India, it's going to be quite a bit different, because they would already have an understanding of Ishwara, and the understanding of Ishwara that they have is much different than the understanding of a Western God. So, but say, you say, there is a God, I believe there is a God, there is something divine, but I don't know what it is. But I believe that it's there, that's Shraddha. Not knowing, but I feel that that is true. Yeah. Even for the teacher, for this teaching, you would say, I don't know that it's true, because how can I know? I haven't learned it yet. How can I really know? But I have Shraddha. So Shraddha is an indefinable in a way. It's like you know you intuit something to be true to the degree that you're willing to study it, even though you don't know. In terms of the teacher, you don't know if the teacher knows or not, but something tells you that it's okay, that you're willing to learn. The whole Shastra really is Tattvamasi, that the Upanishad, that there is a Bhagavan, that there is a God. What is that God? I'm willing to see if there is a God or not. And what is that God?
I have that question.
Right, well, you should have that question. That's right, you should have it. But that's the Shraddha is giving the benefit of the doubt to see. Bhagavan, you could even say something like this, Bhagavan, I don't really know if you're there or who you are, but if you're there, I want to know you. If you're there, I would like to know. You know? Or another person might say, I know that you're there, but I don't know who you are. I would like to know you. Yeah. Another person might say, I hope that you're there.
What about I don't know that you're there, but the rest of this stuff makes sense, so I'm willing to explore.
That's Shraddha. See that I'm
that's as far as
I'm yeah no, but that the Shraddha is that I'm willing to see. That's the Shraddha. What if the lack of Shraddha would be there is no God, it's all a bunch of BS, and no, I'm not willing to see that. I have no Shraddha in that at all. Why would I even want to spend any time? It's nonsense. I have a commitment to it not being true. You see what I mean? My Shraddha is in the faith-pending understanding is that it's not true. And if the Shraddha... Because remember that Shraddha means I don't know. I have... It's almost... It's considered Ishvara Nugraha. It's considered the grace of God because you don't know until you know. You don't know if the teacher knows until you know. You don't know if the Shastra has anything to give you until it gives you. You don't know that there is even a Bhagavan, or what that Bhagavan is, until you recognize it. And so that all requires Shraddha, you know, to even entertain in any significant way the study or the inquiry. And this isn't true. This is true for knowledge, for self-knowledge, for Vedanta. But it's generally true, too, for any knowledge that you undertake or anything you do, there's a reason for it. You have some Shraddha. You have Shraddha in the discipline. You have Shraddha in the teacher that you're studied with. You have Shraddha in the textbooks that you're using, enough to allow you to spend your time with that study, you know. There's something called, we'll do this later when we get to Vedanta Sara on Saturdays or something, finish it. The Anubandha Chatushtaya, the reasons why you involve yourself in any given study, what has to be there for you to involve yourself in the study. You know? And this study is quite a big study. You know, and the Shraddha, and there's so much unknown that you don't have answers for, but you're willing to see for whatever reason what this particular the Upanishads have to say? Why should you be willing to? That you are willing to is considered incredible punya, grace, Ishwara Nigraha, which is really punya. That's how it's treated in India. And that's why students are treated with such kind of care and respect. There's all kinds of verses. There's so many verses that praise the teacher, the guru. There's also so many verses that praise and extol the student. You know, for someone who is even bothers to ask, why am I here? You know, what am I doing here? Who am I in the whole scheme of things? Is there a God? If there is, who are you? You know, what are you? What are you in relation to me? All these kind of questions.
I don't know if it's appropriate today, but what is the Indian concept of God, and how does it differ from the Western concept? You've alluded to that on a number of occasions.
We could get more into that in the Mandukya. You haven't had a lot of unfoldment around that. But just to say it very quickly and know that there's like a lot of things to say about it. If we think of the just conscious being, the being that in fact is your core, that conscious being, as being the one non-dual conscious being of all that is, changeless conscious being. And then what is, we'd say, a mithya attribute of that conscious being is what we call maya. And maya is like an infinite mind, I can use that language, that projects in the form of this entire universe, multi-dimensioned universe. It projects, it's sustained, and it resolves. What doesn't project and resolve is just me, the conscious being, which is the self of all beings. But so what that would means then is that when this consciousness, when it projects in the form of this universe, is a conscious being. It's like an infinite mind, and that's what we call Ishwara. Brahman, the self, plus this, and then with the whole manifest universe, is what is Ishwara. Or Brahman, consciousness, plus this maya, this mithya attribute that manifests as the creation, is what we call the Lord. And that means that when the creation manifests, time and space and duality come with that manifestation, kind of like your dream. You are the Ishwara of your dream, right? The dream comes from you, is sustained by you, resolves into you. So if it was a lucid dream, means when the dream comes, you know who you are. It's not that you're lost in the dream. That's a lucid dream. So say the entire infinite creation comes as a manifestation of infinite knowledge. And that's what we call Ishwara. It's Brahman with this mithya maya.
So there's like an assumption, or maybe it's the results of some conclusion, but that there's a world out there beyond what this being is aware of.
Actually, they do.
If a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, it will make a sound.
It will make a sound.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, but they do look at, just like in Christianity and Judaism, you know, there's heaven and hell worlds. In India, there's many worlds up, seven worlds up, seven worlds down. So there are different planes of existence, but all of those planes exist within duality, within time and space. Brahman is not time and space. Time and space comes with, like, time and space comes with a dream. Time and space comes with the creation. But the creation is Ishwara. There is no creation outside of Ishwara. That's God, which is very, very different from the. Well, if you say it's different from the Christian God, then what Christian God? Like when Saint Thomas Aquinas is talking, you know, about the simplicity of God, and the creatio ex nihilo, the creation comes out of nothing. It starts sounding very much like Brahman and Maya, you know, but they also have duality and all of this type of thing, but. When we, just as lay people, you think of God in heaven, like my mom would say, I just think of God is a man with a white robe and a beard and wings. And then she'll say, isn't that ridiculous? But that's, you know. And then heaven is up there. You know. But that's really just kind of a layman's mythological understanding. And Christian religion goes much deeper than that. It says Judaism and Islam, all of them have a mystical side, but it doesn't necessarily go as far as non-dual, though it touches on it.
Wait, my being, I'm a conscious being, and how do you relate that to the cosmos, the 6 billion light years away stars?
Well, from the standpoint of consciousness, that's irrelevant. Wherever, there's nothing away from consciousness, because say you collapse the whole universe, all that is there is consciousness that doesn't have borders. Consciousness doesn't have time and space, so it's not big or small. Just like for you, your consciousness, if I ask you to imagine a universe, so you have a big imagination, consciousness doesn't become big. You know, but the whole imagination takes place in consciousness. You can't have an imagination that's away from consciousness. So say you have a big imagination, and then say if I ask you to focus on a little ant, you have a little tiny imagination, but from the standpoint of consciousness, it doesn't make any difference. And whatever the size of the imagination is the size of the imagination. It doesn't have a feeling, like whatever is in the imagination is in the imagination. It doesn't think, oh, I'm a big imagination or a small imagination. Whatever the imagination is known.
So when they say pervade...
Pervade, the word like pervade is only from the standpoint of the imagination. It's only from the standpoint of the imagination, not from the standpoint of Atma. You talk like that from the standpoint of time and space. So then you can say, oh, awareness pervades time and space, but actually time and space, you know, can't be away from awareness. But awareness isn't doing any act of pervading. But you're talking about it from the standpoint of the upadi, from the standpoint of the conditioning adjunct, whatever that may be. It might be the whole creation. Right? Kind of a big topic, but that's what we're sitting in with Mandukya. So
yeah.
We'll be sitting there for months.
We're in for it.
We're in for it. Right? Should we